I think I'll let you drive this conversation, Richard, because I really have trouble separating myself from Star Trek The Next Generation. It's the Star Trek that got me into Star Trek. I watched it with my father when I was a kid, and I think I really started getting into Star Trek probably my first year of high school. So that was 1994, I want to say. And that, you know, that was right at the end of the show. So, you know, I have kind of weird interpretations of the show and sort of weird memories of the show and really strange reactions to the show. So I'm curious what you thought of Encounter at Farpoint, you know, as an episode of Star Trek and as an introduction to a new television series.
Well, I will say I have watched Next Generation actually around 94 or so. Similar thing. My dad was watching it, and I caught a couple of the last two or three seasons. So
you've seen probably what, like maybe 10 episodes of the whole show?
No, I've seen a couple seasons worth.
Okay.
But again, very late in the series, half of the characters, you know, Tasha Yar, I did not know because she left the show after a certain point, correct?
Yeah.
The Borg, I kind of really missed a lot of the peak of that plot line. A lot of what people know of The Next Generation, I passed. So it's going to be interesting seeing a lot of this. That said, I've actually seen part of this. The whole trial scene at the beginning, I'd actually seen. I remembered that. I didn't see it in the full episode, I guess. What I think is interesting about this episode is that it is kind of three shows in one.
Yeah, and there's a couple different reasons for that. And
it makes sense for it.
Well, I think Encounter at Farpoint is really interesting, and I think the first season and to a lesser extent the second season of Next Gen is interesting as well, because, you know, for you having seen, you know, let's say a majority of, you know, later seasons, you know, a couple seasons of, you know, maybe 5 and 6 or 6 and 7 or whatever you saw, it was a very different show, and tonally it was different. The look of it was different. And I think a lot of the storytelling qualities were much better in the later seasons. And really what I find interesting about Encounter at Farpoint is how much like the original series it is. And
yeah, well, you have it written by D.C. Fontana and Gene Roddenberry.
It's gonna be. Yeah, and I mean, of course, it's different, because one of the big differences with The Next Generation is that they explicitly set this up to have an ensemble cast. Ensemble casts were very big in 80s TV.
Yeah.
I mean, these were the days of, you know, L.A. Law and Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere. So that was kind of the storytelling du jour. What I find interesting about Encounter at Farpoint is that it very much is the ensemble cast comes together. You have scenes with all of them. You have scenes with like 4 and 5 of the main characters. And that's something that you don't get as much in the later seasons. And it does become a different show. The other thing, of course, is that Q is straight out of the original series.
Yes. Now, from what I know, it's interesting because I know Q becomes a recurrer character throughout the entire series. Like which is a completely correct thing. What the guy playing him is wonderful.
Yeah, he makes like one or two appearances a season usually.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm okay with with seeing him ham it up at any point.
Now here's the thing though. So I know that you know a little bit about Q. Have you seen other Q episodes?
I have, and I believe the very final episode is a Q episode, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, because,
well, I think it changes actually. It sets up the Q portions of this episode, knowing that he's a major part of the series, kind of set up a really interesting thematic motif for it, in that they are explicitly going to a point that's as almost where no man has gone before at this point. They it's the boundaries of where people have really explored. They're using this as a base to get further out. And then you have a divine figure going and saying, nope, you've gone too far. I'm not letting you go back. And, you know, this is essentially them saying, no, we're ready to go further out. We're ready to learn more. So you have this crew of the Enterprise possibly grappling with the limits of knowledge, the limits of exploration, and pushing even further. Now, that had been something that was touched upon in the original series, probably most I hate to say it, but most deliberately in Star Trek V. Here, I think it's done well.
Star Trek what?
Exactly. I mean, the Final Frontier is all about, you know, how do what is the limits of human exploration, and when in this episode ends with them essentially being given the right to go beyond that boundary and to learn more. So I think that's a very interesting parallel, interesting thing that they're setting up. If Q was just a one-time thing, he would be anything. Well, he would just be a Metrons for anything.
Well, Q is problematic for me because I don't really like the character of Q. I think he wears off. I think he gets very tiresome.
And that's fair. And I can see him popping up every few episodes to do this being...
He's and the thing about this episode in particular is that tonally it's very different from his later appearances because he's almost used as comic relief in later episodes. And so here he seems extremely menacing. You don't know what he's going to do. You know, he's killing people left and right, which he doesn't really do ever again. And
yeah,
later, I mean, later I'm trying not to give too much in the way of spoilers for you, but he is very much a trickster character.
Yeah, I get that he...
But it seems like they didn't have a good handle on exactly what his strengths were as an actor, John DeLancey, mm-hmm. and what the value of Q was. Because again, of course, this is written by DC Fontana and Gene Roddenberry. So these are, you know, Star Trek veterans. And the God character, again, is something straight out of the original series. You had Trelane in The Squire of Gothos. Yes. You have the Metrons. You have the Excalibans. I mean, these are just like, this is something that is a standard Star Trek trope. What I like about it is that they do sort of put it on its head a little bit. And, you know, Picard is basically having none of this, right? Like, Kirk would always play along. And Picard is an interesting character. Maybe this is a good way for us to get into the differences between Picard and Kirk. But there's a great line in Encounter at Farpoint where he says something about self-righteous life forms who don't want us to go forward or whatever. You know, he's read Kirk's mission reports. Like, Kirk is really famous in Starfleet and the Federation in general. I'm sure that his mission, they must teach a class on Kirk's missions, right? And so Picard, this takes place.
Again, Kirk's gone to Starfleet Academy once a year to give, you know, a speech.
Exactly.
Like
he's giving guest lectures. I mean, all these things. And this takes place about 70 years after the original series. So, you know, Picard has known all of this. And for him, it's like, oh, here we go. Here's another one of these dicky god beings.
Yeah, he's read about the Metrons. He knows all about that. And he doesn't want to have a... He knows that this is going to lead to just him and an alien in combat in a desert planet. And he has too much shit to deal with.
On a production level, I think the character of Q is interesting because he was created when Paramount wanted to expand this into a 90-minute television movie. This was originally supposed to be a 45-minute pilot. It was only going to be about the Farpoint stuff. And when Paramount said, no, you know what? We want to launch this with a lot of fanfare. We want to have a 90-minute movie. DC Fontana expanded it, came up with the character of Q, this whole courtroom scene and everything, which I actually like because I think it, you know, one of the things about Star Trek The Next Generation in general, one of the missions and sort of the guiding principles of it was, this is a Star Trek show. It's supposed to feel like Star Trek. This is a show for Trekkies, but they didn't want to rely on a lot of the storytelling cliches of the original series. They didn't want to rely on a lot of the sort of alien races of the original series, the technology of the original series. I mean, of course, the Enterprise D looks very different. There's a Klingon on the bridge, but that's the only Klingon we see. And what's going on? Why is there a Klingon on the bridge? You know, like, this is weird. You see a Vulcan, I think, once or twice, just kind of like running through the hallways when they're evacuating.
I think I noticed one, yeah.
There's no mention of Romulans. There's no Andorians, none of that. So you really do get a sense of, yes, this is Star Trek, but we are doing this for people that don't know anything about Star Trek as well. And what I think the Q stuff and the courtroom scenes in particular demonstrate, it's a very quick shorthand to tell those people that aren't familiar with Star Trek what Star Trek is. And Star Trek is a show ultimately about a progressive and optimistic future where humanity has gone beyond what humanity was like 300 or 400 years ago. And you know, it really does. It kind of Encounter at Farpoint tells a lot more often than it shows. And one of the things I like about the Q scenes is that it does show rather than tell.
That makes sense. And yes, the entire plot line is in a way grafted on once they're dealing with there's a point when they're dealing with all the Farpoint stuff and then they're back on the ship and then just Q appears and basically everybody on the bridge kind of reacts like, oh, right, him. And I'd even forgotten about him at that point. I thought that was kind of funny, again, that the cast seemed to react the same way, but, you know, because he is kind of just in the background for most of it. But that said, again, it is interesting enough to watch, and it does give it a broader scope than just being about this one weird space station that had random stuff happen in it.
Well, that's the thing. I think the Farpoint stuff is the weakest part of the episode. You don't really get a good sense of who the Bandy are. You don't really get a good sense of what Farpoint is for. They say it's a space station, but it's on the planet. What is that? That doesn't make any sense. And a lot of that stuff just feels kind of perfunctory, like they needed to have an episode, you know, launch the show. Where the show really excels is in the Q scenes.
Yeah, you have this one wonderfully, you know, exotic looking scene at the end when these jellyfish are rising out of, and it looks really amazing, like, and you know, especially on, we just watched the Blu-ray of it, and it's a really beautifully done scene. I have no idea what the hell any of it means, like, wait, so the ship was a jellyfish and they captured a jelly, it doesn't make any sense, but at that point it doesn't really matter exactly, because again, the Q scenes were so interesting, the character scenes, which is where the real meat of this episode, I would say, is. If the A-plot wasn't 100%, you know, important, well, at least it looked cool enough. You know, I liked some of the sets.
It does have a good payoff. And, you know, what I like about the end of the episode is that it really does set the show up again as this is Star Trek. We do peaceful solutions. We help people. We, you know, assist them and render aid. I mean, you know, the alien jellyfish mate that comes and is destroying the Bandy city, they don't stop it from doing that, but they render, you know, medical assistance, for example. You know, I like that one scene where Q thinks that he's gotten one over on Picard, where he says, you know, oh, you think you're so great. Why aren't you helping them? And he's like, don't worry about it.
He calls the doctor. He's like, what are you doing? Well, we're getting ready to, you know, help all the people down on the planet.
Yeah. And so it's a professional organization. It's a humanitarian organization. I mean, you can even see that in Tasha Yar's line in the courtroom where she said, oh, I grew up on a planet that, you know, had people like you and courts like this, and Starfleet saved me from that. And, you know, whatever you think of that, it's a little strange, but it does kind of set it up as, yes, Starfleet is unequivocally good. It is a force for good in the galaxy, and we are supposed to identify and root for them.
Yeah, this at this point they're still definitely a military organization, but it seems a little more Peace Corps-y than in the first one. You know, Kirk and company explored things and they did help when they needed to, but it seems almost as if this incarnation of the Enterprise is, again, helping people first, and if they need, they have a security team.
Well, let's talk about that, though, because this Enterprise, even in the look of it, I think you can see that, because it's a very different ship than the Enterprise of the original series.
The main bridge is so much cushier. They have, there's that scene where, you know, you have Wesley's like, oh, there's a gym and there's, you know, the holodeck. I can never get bored on this ship. Like, you know, there's children and families. It seems a lot more fun.
It's a bigger ship. It's much bigger. It's much better lit. You know, like even to that basic thing. You know, there's carpet everywhere, which you didn't see on the original Enterprise. There's like soft woods, and you have like these pastel, you know, rugs everywhere, and there's a fish tank in Picard's office, and you know, the chairs look cushy, and there's all these amenities, and yeah, there's families on board, which is, you know, not a insignificant fact.
They have a Siri that works and tells people where to go. I mean, we've seen Kirk get lost on a new version of the Enterprise. This has directions everywhere. Even that is simply,
which I don't think they ever use again, but you know.
Well, you know, I mean, how interesting would it be to see in every episode, where's the bridge? Oh, Richard, to get to the bridge, you go past to the left. and
every
episode, that would be boring.
I mean, it's, you know, and it's one of those things where I think a lot of the Enterprise D is really interesting because in a lot of ways it's almost like a cruise ship. Yeah. And that's kind of what the aesthetic is of it.
Where, that makes sense, yeah.
It feels like that. And it just, it feels more homey. It feels like a place where these people are going to be living as opposed to being assigned.
Well, that has been, again, especially seeing, you know, most of my first Star Trek had been the last few seasons of Next Gen. So seeing the original Enterprise and having to realize, no, essentially picture a submarine, picture a naval base, you know. Picture one of those kind of things. That's what that is. Has had to be a thing that I had to click over because I'm used to it being. But I didn't actually know that the top detaches.
Oh, the saucer section part. Yeah. Well, we can talk about that, but I do want to mention one other thing about the ship that I think is interesting. You know, thematically, I think it fits in because this is a friendlier Star Trek.
Yeah.
This is a more peaceful Star Trek. And, you know, even to the point where, you know, it's interesting to note that the bridge of the Enterprise D and the bridge of the original Enterprise are basically the same size.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that they learn so much more about set construction because it just looks so much bigger,
yeah.
You know, and you get these optical illusions because it looks a lot deeper than it is because you've got those ramps that go up to the back computers.
Yeah.
You've got the horseshoe, wood horseshoe that kind of like breaks it up to make it look even bigger than it is. And, you know, even to the point where they use these interesting camera angles to give you sort of a depth of field where, you know, you come over, you come out of the back turbo lift and you're sort of seeing, you know, the entire width and depth of the bridge. And it just looks huge. Not something you would have seen in the original Enterprise. And it really does make you realize that this is a much bigger ship. This is a much more technologically advanced ship. I mean, Picard even says that. This is a brand new ship. This is like their flagship, and it sets it up as a very different show than the original series, which was about like, this is a ship, it's a captain, it's a crew, but there's nothing particularly special about the original Enterprise.
Yeah, this is one of 20 shows that are going on in this at the same exact time. It's just, we have to pick one.
Right. Whereas you get the sense in at least in Encounter at Farpoint that, yeah, maybe the crew is something special. We don't know. We've just been introduced to them. But the ship puts them apart. They have a lot of technology at their disposal. And I think that's an interesting distinction. I don't know if that means anything. But it kind of speaks, I think, to sort of the optimism of technology, especially that people had in the 80s and where, you know, things were going to be going forward and, you know, technology was moving forward and forward and forward. And that just wasn't true in the 60s. So that's kind of interesting as well, I think.
Also, keep in mind, what was technology in the 60s for? That was the arms race. That was the Cold War. That was us versus Russia. In the 80s, that's when you have the rise of the PC, when you have computers going into offices and making, you know, life better in very obvious and demonstrable ways. So just, I mean, politically the situation is completely different, and that alone would make technology change.
Yeah.
But the episode, it's very interesting because they need to make this very different from, you know, you were talking about the differences between Picard and Kirk. But really they go out of their way to make it none of the characters different versions of the original Star Trek. There's a lot of characters.
And that was very deliberate.
Oh, it is very obviously deliberate. I mean, number one, a lot of the characters don't have the same jobs. There is no equivalent of Counselor Troy on the original series. You know, Uhura, there is no, you know, person on the bridge doing, you know, just comms work. When you have people who are, you know, there's a doctor in both series, and Dr. Crusher and Bones could not be any different. Geordi is Scotty's job, right?
Not in the first season.
Okay. But he is in engineering either way. He is some kind of...
He's not actually.
No.
He becomes the chief engineer in the second season. In the first season, he's sort of a, you know, jack of all trades.
Okay.
Moves around from episode to episode.
Either way, personality-wise, he and Scotty are very different.
And I think I think that that's indicative of something where they didn't have a chief engineer as part of the main cast in this show originally as the conception of it. And I think that was deliberate. I think that was, you know, part to set it apart.
No. We have the security chief as one of the main characters, and you know, something that makes so much more sense than, you know, just having the captain and two other people.
Yeah.
You know, I think you said that very deliberately. Picard does not go on away missions.
Yeah. And they have a scene about that. I mean, you know, there is something where, you know, they are setting this up as different. They're saying, no, Picard is a more deliberative captain.
Yeah.
He's perhaps more thoughtful. He's going to think before he acts, where Kirk more often would just act. You know, where Kirk acts on instinct, and he has great instincts, and he uses his emotions to drive himself forward and make correct decisions. You know, you get the sense that Picard is a different captain because, at least in this episode, he's very deliberative and he doesn't seem to want to show his hand, even to the point where he's kind of standoffish. He's kind of grumpy in a way.
Yeah.
And that's something that leaves the character a little bit as the show ages, but it's always kind of there.
Well, I love that scene where he's talking to Riker when they first meet up, which I have a question about in a second, but maybe we'll get to that. And he's saying, you know, I need you to do me a favor. You know, there's kids on the ship and I am horrible with kids. And, you know, as the captain, I need to project a certain image. So help, you know.
Right.
That's something that, number one, Kirk does not have that weakness. Number two, if he had that weakness, I don't think he would. I don't know. I keep trying to think, well, what would Kirk do if he felt that? And it seems so contradictory to his character to ever worry about. Kirk knows wherever he's go, he's going to be the coolest guy in the room. You know, he's...
And Picard's not worried about being cool.
No, but...
I think that's the difference,
but
right? Like,
no, but not... Well, when I say cool, that's not exact... Maybe it's a different term, but Picard does want to be looked up to, and he does stay a little more distant from the other characters. I mean, they... A couple of the... You know, what's his name? Wesley says, you know, he's afraid of the captain, and... you know, Dr. Crusher doesn't disagree. You know,
and it turns out that they have some history.
Oh, yes. But I get the sense that, you know, Picard wants to, you know, be close with these people, but he also realizes, no, he's the captain. He does need to stand a little apart. He does need to, in a way, I almost wonder if that's the way that Picard deals with, you know, difficult decisions, is that he doesn't have as many connections.
Yeah, people. I think that's a main difference between the two captains, is that Kirk very much is someone who is not afraid of being friends with his crew,
yeah,
and his subordinates, and he's someone who can be a friend to someone, but also it can send them in to die if need be.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's very, very loyal to his crew, and he will go out of his way. He will break regulations. He will disobey,
yeah,
orders. I mean, look at the search for Spock. Where,
yeah, I was about to say, we've seen, especially in the movies, that paying off.
Yeah. He steals the Enterprise to save his friend.
And the rest of his crew don't even think twice about, well, Kirk's doing that. Like, They all have a very close and, you know, affectionate relationship to each other. And
you don't get the sense that these characters do. Now, partly that is because a lot of them have just met, but
yeah,
also partly because you get the sense that that's not what Picard wants.
No, this is this is a workplace where they all do have respect for each other, and they do. I mean, I especially knowing from what you've said that they mandate that there are no disagreements within the crew. But at the same time, that makes sense if they are a little less personally invested in each other.
Yeah.
Because, well, of course, there is no reason to have an actual argument with this person because, you know, it's nothing personal. We're just trying to figure out the best way to do this job. And ultimately, it can be discussed into something, so it's not worth getting upset about. I mean, that I like. That's the kind of work environment I would prefer.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, though, a lot of them do become friends. And
which is going to happen anyway when you're in such close quarters, in such life or death missions week after week.
And I do think it's interesting, you know, I want to talk about Data because, you know, I think he's a very interesting character.
Yeah.
And I think he's perhaps the closest analog to an original series character that we have. You know, he's kind of the Spock character in a way. He's apart from the rest of them in a very real way. He's an android. He doesn't have a sense of humor, but I mean, he literally doesn't have a sense of humor. He literally doesn't have any emotions. But he's also someone who wants emotions and wants to be human and even says that in the first episode. And so it kind of sets him up as a very,
yeah,
different character than Spock. I think they are similar, perhaps intellectually, but not in their desires.
Well, then that makes sense why he's the one who has the scene with Bones in a way. And I mean, they do, address it at that point, you know, when...
And how great is that scene?
Oh, that was... I have to say, when I first saw that, I was like, oh my God, he looked terrible at that point. Like, is that really how old he was? I knew he... And then I'm like, wait, like, all right, somewhere in between 3 and 4, like, was this when this was filmed?
Yeah, four and five.
Okay, but I'm like, yeah, if I just gotta watch Star Trek 4, and that's pretty much what he looked like, you know, right? Makeup. Yeah. But yeah, he does specifically, you know, he thinks he's a Vulcan for a minute when he, you know, answers a question very, you know, when he knows his record like intimately or something like that.
Well, he doesn't think he's a Vulcan, but
well, he may have made a joke, but you know, because he's saying like, you know, only Vulcans have, you know, something, you know, are that precise. And then he says, well, I'm actually an android. Oh, great. You know, pretty much the same thing.
That's even worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think putting those two characters together, you know, does lend a sort of torch, you know, passing the torch in a way. You know, McCoy and Spock were always one of the great duos of the original series. Yeah. And, you know, putting McCoy and Data together kind of is a way to bridge that gap a little bit. It's a way for McCoy to get some good jibes in, because of course Bones is the best character when he has someone like Data or Spock to, you know, insult. And it also just puts it, you know, it puts a nice capper on the whole Enterprise thing, because he said, you know, treat her like a lady, she'll always send you home, you know, whatever that was.
Well, a couple of things that I'm curious from this. So are there fewer Vulcans around at this point? Because
no,
Data doesn't seem to have met any, you know. He says, you know, aren't Vulcans supposed to be the, you know, this great cultured society or the most advanced, you know. The way he says it, it doesn't seem like he's actually encountered any. I get the sense if Data had met several, he would have said, you know, every Vulcan I've met has been very, you know, has been wonderful, and they're the most advanced, you know. It really feels like he would have used a specific anecdote.
I mean, I guess a lot of that is just a new show. It's a pilot. You know, they don't have the backstories fleshed out. I mean, at some point, Data says that he's from the class of 78, and that's completely wrong, because later on it's established that the show starts like in 2362 or something. So it's like, you know, it's a new show, and they don't have everything worked out.
Yeah, I mean, didn't ruin the day for me.
And there are changed premises. I mean, you know, they mentioned the Ferengi in this episode very obliquely, and the Ferengi were supposed to be the new Klingons, the new Romulans, and that very quickly didn't work out because they are absolutely ridiculous. But
yeah, but I mean, they're very... They're implied to be this bloodthirsty, like, doesn't, you know, he say, you know, I hope they find you as, what's the word? He says something like, I hope they find you as tasty as they did their last associates.
Yeah.
Like, it implies that they're going to kill and eat them, you know, like, specifically.
So they were doing something with the Ferengi, but that very much did not work out, as you will see. And it's funny because I think, you know, they were trying to set up the show to be very different from the original series and the movies, but at the same time, they wanted to have a backstory, and they didn't always have the backstory worked out. And I think that Data thing is just part of that backstory that they didn't have worked out, you know, because we did see a Vulcan on the Enterprise. So
anyway, again, either way, that's not the point of the scene, certainly, but again, the show is going out of its way to say, you know, even that scene, even all the scenes with Data he's a little similar to Spock, but he is very different, and here's why. And again, they don't want this to be, you know, it's a new generation of Star Trek, but it's not a carbon copy of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because it is dealing with a very different set of societal values. I mean, this show is about the late 80s, just as Star Trek was about the late 60s. So you can't have the same, you know, the same characters don't make sense in the 80s. We've seen Kirk and company in the 80s already. We don't need to have that part two.
Well, that's kind of the thing, right? I mean, like, you know, the 80s were the decade of consensus, and everybody had to agree. And, you know, you see a lot of that in this show, where, you know, even to the, I mean, I think ensemble casts were popular in the 80s for precisely that reason. And even to the point where, you know, Roddenberry did decree that all the main characters had to get along, and it's like, okay, but where does the drama come from, right? And they had to get the drama from outside characters and from outside races. And, you know, what I think is most 80s about the show is the character of Troy in a lot of ways.
Oh, God, her hair.
I mean, they have a psychologist in the main cast. And, I mean, yeah, her hair. But, you know, it's just something that I think that is the thing more than anything else that says, yes, this is a different show than the original series.
And she's not just a, you know, ship's function. I mean, they have a psychologist on the ship just as they have a cook on the ship and just as they have somebody who is coming up with activities for the recreation, for the gym every week, but they're not on the bridge. The counselor is.
Yeah, she's sitting next to the captain. I mean, that is in itself an indication that she is an extremely important part of the mission and an important part of the crew.
But I can't tell why, because every single thing she says...
And you never really will.
And I know, I mean, like, before watching this, I thought that it was just kind of a joke about how... You know, oh, you know, the Klingons, you know, smashing things. And she says, I sense anger. But that's literally what's happening in this. I have a feeling she's not so much psychic as she is really good at cold reading or she, you know.
Well, she's not psychic. I mean, she even says
that. Well, whatever she has, like, no, she's just.
She's an empath. She can sense emotion, but she can't read minds. She's not a telepath.
So not useful. Like, they. At the end, when she see, you know, when they save the thing, she's like, well, they're very joyful, both of them. And I'm like, well, no.
I mean, I will defend Troy a little bit because I do think she has her value in this episode. I think she does indicate she is the person who first indicates that, you know, Farpoint Station is a life form because she's feeling these emotions.
Yes, of course.
She's sensing that something is wrong. And I don't think that they necessarily would have picked up on that if she wasn't there.
It seems like the kind of character who they could do a lot with, but they didn't exactly make her interesting in this. And from what I know, they apparently never really figure out.
You know, not really, but as you will see, I think, you know, but speak about that in terms of the 80s again, because, you know, of course, that is a very 80s thing to have. It's a psychologist on the main crew of the ship.
Sure, and it's just personally, she can be very of, I'm sure she's of use.
It's very strange because I think there was a sense in the original series that your emotions are your strength and you shouldn't really examine them too much. Whereas in this show, it seems like all they want to do is examine emotions. And Troy is like the embodiment of that.
Yeah.
It's the touchy-feely decade, right?
Maybe that's why I don't like it. I don't like emotions.
Well, that could be.
That could be. I hate having feelings.
Yeah. But it is, though. It's the touchy-feely decade. And Troy's there.
That does make sense.
Yeah, that's why she's there, in effect.
Yeah, and I could also certainly see how, you know, being an empath would make you would be really helpful as a therapist, you know?
Now, what do you think of the treatment of the female characters?
They are not necessarily treated as, I don't want to say they're not treated like they're women in a way, because I mean, certainly, but there's no, you know, Yar doesn't have any, you know, specific, you know, it's not commented at all. Dr. Crusher has a son and has a husband who died. But beyond that, Troy and Riker had a thing, but that's about it. Like, only as it dictates who they would be having a personal relationship with, you know. But beyond that, you know, it doesn't seem to affect their competence or anything or their personality or their intelligence in such a way that it's not even commented on. Like,
and that's a very different.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that this episode notices that they're women.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's true. And I think, you know, that is something that may change a little bit as we get further into the show. But I generally like the treatment of the female characters in the pilot. And, you know, I don't think that they're treated as different than the men for any reason. And even to the point where, I mean, even little things like, you know, the miniskirts make an appearance in this episode and men are wearing them, right?
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
That's something that goes away after a while.
Okay.
You don't see that. I mean, the miniskirts in general go away after a few episodes, but it was just one of those things where the show was kind of going out of its way to have gender equality, even to the point of costuming, where it's like, no, men wear these things too. And it's a little ridiculous, but
only because it was filmed in 1986, and, you know, seeing a man walking in a skirt in 1986 is a thing of comedy. It's
I mean, it still is.
Yeah, for better or for worse, and, you know, that's not necessarily, I don't necessarily agree that it inherently is, but that said, that's the reason that you can't necessarily show someone in the future wearing it, because that you are going to still have today's viewpoint to it. It is going to be a man in a skirt.
Yeah.
But again, that said, they treat these characters the same way they do, you know, the blind guy or the android. I mean, like, you know, they don't make it seem like any of those can inhibit anyone from doing their job.
Yeah, it's very much, I think there was a sense in the original series that certain, I mean, even to the point where something like Turnabout Intruder, where being a woman is viewed as a handicap, and yeah. It's like this incredibly sexist episode, and, you know, there's none of that in this show, and, you know, handicaps are not a strength, but they're not a weakness, they just are,
No. And
you have to get around them, and you can do your job, and nobody views you any less than that.
And, you know, and I think his...
Not that I'm equating being a woman with a handicap, but I think in a lot of... I only say that because that's the viewpoint that the original series had sometimes.
Well, maybe we'll not say handicap, but minority. I mean...
No, I would say the original series did view being a woman as a handicap sometimes.
Give it the third step. A woman is a minority, and a minority is a handicap, I think, was more of the... but either way, Geordi's relationship to his handicap is interesting because he has this, you know, these implants or whatever that he says give him constant pain, but because of that, he's able to... In a way, can see better than everybody else. You know, when he's talking about temperature changes and he sees the molecular structure of stuff.
He's basically a walking tricorder.
Yeah, exactly. And so he has, it's interesting how he's always going to be, I mean, no judgment with the word, flawed in some way. Again, he either has to have, you know, pain or blindness or surgery, which could end up harming him even more than either of the two. And I assume that that is one of his major things that he deals with over the series.
Not really.
Oh.
Sorry.
Damn it.
But I think in general, though, if you, again, I mean, we're comparing this a lot to the original series, but I think you sort of have to. Because the show really doesn't have its own identity at this point.
Whoa.
And, you know, if you look at the crew of the original Enterprise, they were all very similar to each other, except for Spock. Spock was the odd man out. What's interesting about The Next Generation is that it's very explicitly set up as a crew of misfits. And I don't mean misfits in the sense that these are broken people or harmed or in any way. It's just they're all different. And again, it's that idealism of the future where everybody can work together no matter where you come from, what your background is, what your handicap is, you know, whether you're a man, a woman, a Klingon, whatever. You know, I mean, no matter what it is, we can all work together. We can all figure out solutions to our problems. And at the end of the day, the episode does put that forward, I think, and that's its strongest message more than anything else.
I mean, yeah, the tagline even of the show now very explicitly says where no one has gone before. I was thinking about that phase two book that you lent me, where they copied a note from Roddenberry where he was saying, you know, at this point I want to make the gender equality a lot more because it is several years later, both in history and, you know, within the show. So he said there would naturally be more women in Starfleet. And he said, you know, I wanted to have, you know, he was originally throwing around having a yeoman character who was a major plot. And he said, but that, you know, that's going to be a woman who's basically a secretary. And I don't know if that's enough. So, you know, this seems like, well, yeah. And a good 10 years later, this is what would be, you know, this is even more gender equality.
There are no yeomans in this show.
Yeah, or at least none that we see.
There are no space secretaries running around. And I think that's very important.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's another indication that the show has moved forward and that Star Trek has moved forward and does adapt to the times that it is being made in. I think it's interesting that you mentioned phase two because, I'm curious if you had picked up on any of the character stuff that made it into the characters of The Next Generation, because I think that, you know, Riker and Troy and their relationship and their past is, and this was something that was used in the motion picture, but this was supposed to be, it's kind of the major plot, one of the major sort of plot points of the Phase 2 TV show.
Okay.
That Decker and Aaliyah had this past and they had this mysterious relationship that had ended. And of course that's picked up in Riker and Troy. You know, we get an indication that they know each other. We don't know exactly what their relationship was like, but
yeah,
you know, it seems likely that if Troy can project her thoughts to anyone, it has to be someone that she's extremely emotionally attached to. And well, so that's yeah, a very, and that's a very intimate thing to do.
I mean, when she very also specifically says, you know, can you still hear my thoughts? You know, it implies that they had been extremely close and they haven't been for a while. And right now I'm just keeping it as, you know, they're both in Starfleet. It could be any one of a dozen reasons why they were separated. They were just, you know, maybe they were just in town for a week on a mission and, you know, but then had to go separately. It doesn't.
I mean, I disagree with you because I think that, you know, we don't know what their relationship was, but I think the very fact that she is allowing him to read his thoughts means that they had an extremely emotionally close relationship.
Oh, I'm saying they definitely had a close relationship. I don't, the reason it ended, I mean, I don't necessarily, it doesn't really matter. It could be any one of a number of reasons.
Riker doesn't seem happy to see her though.
No. And she, yeah.
So what does that indicate?
Well, he's uncomfortable that his old girlfriend's in town and that she needs to brush her hair.
Yeah, her hair is not good.
I don't necessarily like either of them, and I really don't necessarily like her right now.
Well, that's interesting. Talk about that. I mean, why don't you like them?
I
don't know that you're supposed to like them.
Well, they just haven't done anything cool, I guess, is the thing. Like, I mean, I love Geordi LaForge because he's LeVar Burton. I love Worf because he's Worf. I love Picard because he's Patrick. You know, like, there's reasons I like all the characters. She just kind of stands around and says the obvious and doesn't really, I don't really feel like she added much to this, you know, to the experience. So I guess it's less that you know, maybe it's more that it's not that I dislike her. There's nothing that she'd done that makes me hate her. But she's just not won my heart yet. And which is, I remember liking her as a kid.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that she leaves much of an impression in this episode. I don't think that Riker does either. I mean,
but
I think,
again, it's first episode.
You know, we haven't talked much about Riker, but I think he is, you know, very much in the Kirk mold in certain respects. He's young. You know, he's very hungry for a career.
I get the sense that, I mean, and Dr. Crusher implies this, that he's a bit too eager. I mean, he's, you know, saying, oh, everything is mysterious. And she's like, dude, you don't need to make more work for yourself. Like, you're the first mate already, you know, get on the ship. These are your last couple days before you, you know, have a lot of work to do. Like, I'm just going to shop for clothes and I'm going to make a dress and that's what I'm doing. You know,
well, but I think in some ways that's interesting because I think it sets up Dr. Crusher as someone who is further along in her career and has more experience than Riker. You know, yes, Riker is the first officer of the Enterprise, of the flagship of Starfleet. And he is obviously on a career trajectory that is going to take him very far. While Dr. Crusher, you know, in that scene with Picard later, it's indicated that she specifically requested the chief medical officer position on the Enterprise D.
That's
not something that you can do if you don't have a lot of cachet with your superiors.
No, she's the kind of person who can request any assignment. And I mean, she gets almost a little slightly offended when he says, you know, well, you know, when he implies that she was just posted there by mistake. And she's like, you know, there's a reason I want to be on here. And also, you know, at the level of the career that she's at, certainly that would, you know, this is,
like, it does seem a little strange though that Picard has absolutely no say over his key officers.
Well, like, yeah, I wondered if it's,
you think that he would be getting resumes and he'd be picking from them.
You,
like,
would think that he would pick his first officer himself, as like, even if they were to, you know, even if he didn't have a choice over most of the crew, the guy who is supposed to be his right hand. I mean, Kirk has obviously requested Spock on every single assignment he's ever been on, you know?
Yeah.
I almost wonder if that means that Picard didn't make enough connections and doesn't really have too many people that he trusts enough. I mean, I get the sense that he knows Worf a little better, and I think he knows Tasha a little better. I don't know if that's just because he's been flying them for them with them for a couple weeks at this point, but I think he might have had other postings with them, or I think he knew them already.
Yeah.
I almost wonder if he doesn't know a person that he doesn't know anyone else who would be a good medical chief or doesn't have a good first officer and just had Starfleet pick for him.
I mean, it's interesting, right? Because Picard is obviously a captain who is extremely adept and extremely talented and extremely well-connected, because you don't get chosen by Starfleet brass to be the captain of the new Federation flagship unless you're a very great captain. At the same time, I think there is an indication that Picard, you're right, I think he doesn't make friends, and I think he does that deliberately. I think he does like to set himself apart, and I think the indication there is that Picard will work with people who Starfleet thinks he should work with, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That he doesn't, he's not interested in, and this is something as well, I think, in the show in general, is that the idea that anybody in the future can work together, because we all agree that we're all there to do a job and we're all there to, you know, we can all get along because we have no problem with differences. And, you know, whoever you are, I can work with you. I can like you. I can talk to you. And that itself is a form of optimism. But, you know, obviously that we're never going to get rid of interpersonal conflicts, and that is extremely unrealistic, but you have to accept it for the show that it is. But I think there is an indication there that Picard almost maybe thinks that Starfleet knows better than him. And
that could be. I mean, when he meets Riker, he says, "I have one question for you." And he asks about this. There had been this incident where his captain wanted to beam down, and Riker explicitly, you know, didn't let him do that, or because he felt that the, you know, it wasn't safe enough. And
right.
Picard questions that, and, you know, Riker basically says, "Well, look, you know, you're hiring me to do the job of you know, to, you know, double checking on whether it's safe or not. And, you know, I did that, you know, that's the reason I'm here, and I'm going to do that job no matter what." And that's all Picard needs.
Yeah.
Picard doesn't really care who's looking out for him, but he just, that satisfies him that he knows that Riker's going to look out for him enough.
Yeah. And I think that's a very key scene, because I think that's the first moment where Picard trusts Riker and he says, okay, this is going to be a guy I can work with, because he is going to have my safety and best interest at heart. He is going to have the ship's best interest at heart. And, you know, whatever else we find out about each other as the mission goes forward, I know at least that he's going to be someone who stands up for what he believes in.
And, you know, and that's when he mentions the children thing. And if Riker had not answered those questions to his satisfaction, Picard would not have said, "Well, I don't like kids, help me."
Yeah, I think that's true.
Speaking of not liking kids, now I understand why everyone hates Wesley.
Oh, yeah, Wesley. Well, he's a problematic character, and it's funny because, you know, I was doing a little bit of background reading in preparation for recording this, and it's stuff that I had sort of forgotten. You know, there's a great Star Trek companion book by Larry Nemechek, which is very famous, and, you know, it has some good background material, casting sheets and things like that. And the original, it's funny because a lot of the characters were very different in the initial conception.
Yeah.
You know, Tasha Yar was supposed to be a Hispanic, kind of like the aliens character, the Marine. Mm. You know, Troy was supposed to be exotic and sort of, you know, sort of Icelandic or Far East or whatever.
Does she have, what accent is she using, and does she keep that?
Well, Marina Sirtis is British, and so she's using some sort of modified accent. It doesn't really have any sort of real world analog. It's just an accent that she came up with.
Okay.
You know, Data was supposed to be played by a non-white guy. And most interestingly, Wesley was supposed to be a woman named Leslie, and was supposed to be a 16-year-old girl or a 15-year-old girl. And I kind of wished they had gone with that, because originally Roddenberry wanted her to be a female and then made her a male. His middle name is Wesley, and kind of, you know, it was, again, Roddenberry likes to put himself into the characters that he creates. And
yeah,
he was in a lot of ways very protective of the character of Wesley, which is why he was on the show for so long. And, you know, he never really added a whole lot to the show. He was kind of whiny, and you'll see a lot of that later.
Like, it seems like they... I mean, I get the sense that they kind of want Wesley to be every kid who's watching the show. And like, gee whiz, if I could go on the bridge of the Enterprise, how cool would that be, you know? And yeah, but...
That's kind of it. And I think, yeah, you know, it's I think he's a problematic character that we don't really get a reason for until later. But, you know, I think it would have been interesting if it had been a female teenager character, certainly, instead. And I mean, it's interesting because Roddenberry said that he felt that the storytelling opportunities would be greater if he was a man. And it's like, I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, I was going to say that seems to completely go against everything everything the show has ever felt about, you know, especially at this point. I mean, they could very much have a 16-year-old girl who's... she's getting to the point where she's about to, you know, start studying and, you know, being an adult. So what is she doing? You know, if she, you know,
and I think that would have been interesting, yeah, because I mean, you know, how many interesting, you know, female teenage characters were on TV at this point?
More than, no, I don't know. Like, this was around the time I was watching, a couple of years later was Clarissa Explains It All, I guess.
That was like 5 years later. I mean, this was, you know.
It was just about to.
But that was a kid show.
But yeah, I mean, like, I guess a few years later, maybe if this had happened, you know, had started in 1990, 1991, they would have been a little more receptive to having a teenage
girl. That's actually a good point.
Maybe it is just a couple years too early for that.
Yeah, that could be. That could be.
And of course, nowadays, you couldn't have a teenage girl character. Well, maybe you could. Played by Miley Cyrus.
So we've talked a lot about the characters, and we've talked a lot about some of the themes of the episode. And I think maybe a good place to talk about last is, you know, some of the qualities of the script and some of the special effects, because, you know, obviously the special effects in the show are much better than the original series. And, you know, the special effects were done by Industrial Light and Magic for the first episode. But they also, I think, fall into the motion picture trap a little bit, because, you know, this episode, again, like we said at the beginning, was supposed to originally be a 45-minute episode, and they sort of expanded it out. And it does have some pacing issues. It does have some scenes that go on too long. There are scenes that don't serve any real purpose.
Like, on one hand, I mean, there was definitely a lot of that in the movie. There were all, like, the transporter scene was a big one where it just... Now, there was a few of those. The conversation between Dr. Crusher and Geordi does nothing, goes nowhere.
And actually, that was added later because the episode was running short.
But that gives a very clear indication of who is he, who is she, what is their relationship. I mean, the holodeck sequence doesn't really do much for the actual plot. All they're doing is looking for Data to get, you know, some information. But it explains, like, there's a lot more world building, but because they're actually using this as the start to a series, it makes a lot more sense, and it's a lot more acceptable. I mean, I don't need to have scenes between Decker and Ilea because, well, they're gone by the end of the movie. You know, you don't need to give me a tour of the wreck deck on the new Enterprise because we're never going to see that again. You know, in this, talking to the holodeck, I mean, I know that there are plenty of episodes which use it as a plot point or as a location.
Yeah.
These are characters we are going to spend 117 episodes with. So,
no, more than that.
How many? 170, maybe?
Something like that.
I noticed the number. So it makes sense to have some. Again, see, like I said, there were three episodes. There's the court episode, there's the jellyfish episode, and then there's just a couple of random, you know, people on the ship having a conversation when Picard is with that whole thing with Wesley on the bridge. That's nothing but characterization. That's very important at this point. Again,
I think that's interesting because, you know, one of the problems I have with the episode is the saucer separation sequence.
Well, and there's that because
that was extremely just had no point.
That's
basically
characters being in awe of a normal ship function. And
I mean, it's interesting to watch maybe the first time, but you know, interestingly enough, the original Enterprise was supposed to have that ability, and of course they never could show that. Now they can show it, and they show it, and it's like, not only do we see it once, we see it twice. I mean, that's a bit much.
It answers a very good question, as in, well, gee, these people are going into deepest space and they will encounter dangers. I mean, yeah, there would be no series if they never did, you know. I know that there are, again, I know naval, you know, Air Force bases in the real world have families on them, but they're also not expecting to be bombed every day.
Well, neither is this ship, though, right? I mean, that's the real difference here is that, you know, the original Enterprise was not a warship, but it was definitely an exploration ship, but it was well-armed because the galaxy had been much less explored.
But again, given that there's eventually a series, then that comes off like poor foresight.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
As in, I mean, these 170 episodes, how many times is the Enterprise going to be in danger over the course of the next several seasons?
I mean, yeah, it will be, but...
You would get the sense that if they...
But here's the thing about that, is that the Enterprise is a ship where its mission is exploration, its mission is humanitarian, yeah. It is not a warship, it is not going into battle, and so the ship is never destroyed. And it's one of those things where you sort of have to accept it as far as it goes and also think about it in terms of, again, you know, their first instinct is not violence. Their second instinct is not violence. They're, you know, they will exhaust all other possibilities to avoid that. And I think especially the saucer separation sequence does have at least some point because it does say, yes, they've thought about this.
Yeah, that's, I guess, what I meant. Like, they need to have, yes, they Picard will never go for his phaser first thing. I don't doubt that everybody on that ship will do their damnedest to get out of a confrontation. And then you have a ship beam from another dimension and, you know, immediately zap them up.
And I mean, in terms of the 170 episodes, how many episodes feature the ship itself being in grave danger? Not that many of them, actually.
Okay, I'm going by the original ship, I guess.
So. Yeah, you know, that's the interesting thing about Next Generation, I think, in general, is that, you know, it is a show that is much less about the ship in danger and much more about characters, and it's a character-based show, much more than the original series. And what you see is a lot of character-based drama more than action drama.
Okay.
It's an 80s show.
I love the 80s.
And what I think is most interesting about the show, and, you know, maybe something that you can watch going forward, is the fact that this is a much more well-constructed setup. It's a much more thought-out world than you got.
And I can certainly see that already
in the pilots of the original series. And in general, it's just a much more thought-out world.
We'll put it this way. At the beginning of the first season, you know, even at the end of Star Trek, the original series, I think if we asked what's Starfleet, what's the Federation, we wouldn't have really gotten an answer. I think at this point, they know all of the answers. So there's a Bible to this show that is much more detailed than there was in the original series. That goes with it being 20 years later, certainly.
And again, they very explicitly know what Starfleet and the Federation are.
Yeah, they also have.
Because of that courtroom scene. And I mean, that sets up the show right there. This is what Starfleet is. This is the show you're watching.
And that's it. They simply have two series and several movies more of background to work with, and, you know, not even counting the stuff that they created for this show. I mean, I'm sure when the pre-production involved looking at all of the old episodes and going forward.
I mean, even, you know, well, I don't know about that, but I think, you know, definitely a lot of people that were working on the original series worked on this show. And so the you know, continuity was there. You know, DC Fontana was working on the show. Gene Roddenberry, of course. Zimmerman was working on the show. Robert Justman was a supervising producer on The Next Generation for a while. So there were a lot of people that worked on both. And, you know, that's to its detriment and to its credit at the same time. And I think, you know, what you'll see over the course of the first season, especially of The Next Generation, is a show that is struggling with, you know, and I think you can see this in this episode, it's struggling with making a show that is modern and that has modern sensibilities, but it has people working on it that perhaps, you know, are great at their jobs, but don't really get television in 1987, and the show doesn't really find its legs until season 3, and that's kind of where we leave The Next Generation at the end of Encounter at Farpoint. We don't really get a sense of what kind of show it's going to be. We think it's going to be a Star Trek show. Is it going to be like the original series? Is it not? What's it going to feel like? What's it going to look like from week to week? We don't know.
We'll find out.
I think that we should give these episodes Wesley Crushers.
Oh, no. I really don't want to have to give something 6 Wesley Crushers. But there's 6 of them running around in my head screaming.
This episode is probably a 5 for me.
That's fair.
So next week, we continue our voyage into the future, into the 24th century, with the episodes The Naked Now and Code of Honor. So join us then.